Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here, and it is Conference Championship Preview Podcast. I was going to put week in there somewhere. I didn't know where it was going to go in the middle of that statement, but it is a week, and the conference championships are coming up, and we are going to preview them here on the show today. A little later on, we are going to have Field Yates coming on to preview the AFC Championship game between the Patriots and the Chiefs. But starting first, frequent contributor to the show, much beloved guest among our listeners, it is ESPN's Dan Graziano to preview the NFC Championship game. Dan, how are you?
I'm fantastic, Bill. It's long been a dream of mine to open for Field Yates.
Well, this is your chance. I think of myself more as sort of the tech guy for both of you. I'm the one setting up your guitars so you can both play. I'm the roadie.
Yeah.
I'm the roadie on this tour of
to play
men at ESPN with excellent hair.
So, I wonder if Field knows how to play guitar. I don't know how to play guitar, but maybe he does.
I feel like it's...
find out later.
Yeah, I'll ask him later if he knows how to play guitar. Yeah. Do you want to bet? Do you feel like he... What would you set the odds at that Field Yates knows how to play guitar?
I don't. I would think he doesn't.
He does not.
I'm curious. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It just doesn't seem like... But I don't know. He's a man of many talents. So, you know, sometimes those people surprise you.
I'll tell you who else is a man of many talents. That is Sean Payton of the New Orleans Saints.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start this conversation by talking about something sort of related to the NFC Championship game, but not exactly. And we talk a lot about coaches with you on the show. Every year we do our draft of coaches, our hot seat draft. And this year we had eight coaches lose their jobs by the end of the year. In some cases, fortunately, I guess, for the fans, in some cases, unfortunately. But what I found really interesting in thinking about this coaching process is this. So, of course, we all know everyone wanted to get Sean McVay, someone who looked like Sean McVay, someone who is vaguely friends with Sean McVay. Everyone knows that. We don't have to get into that. But on the other side of this game, there was Sean Payton, who has been an excellent head coach for a long time, run a great team, specifically a great offense. So they've worked very well with different offensive players. It's always been Drew Brees, but plenty of offensive personnel have come and gone over that time frame. Is it weird that Pete Carmichael has been the offensive coordinator for this team for a long time now, 7 or 8 years, if I'm not mistaken, he's called plays on and off. Is it weird that there hasn't been any interest in him really as a head coaching candidate? The same with Dan Campbell, who got a couple of interviews this year after being the Dolphins interim coach, and he's on the staff of the Saints. Dennis Allen, who improved this defense dramatically over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Are you surprised there hasn't been more interest in the Saints staff for head coaching opportunities?
Yeah, there isn't much about this head coaching cycle that failed to surprise me. I think it's the whole thing has been very weird from the start. I mean, you mentioned the McVay obsession to the point where the Cardinals put on their press release about Cliff Kingsbury that he was friends with Sean McVay. Like, no professional connection, but that line is actually in their press release, which is insane. But I guess everybody just wants everybody to know that there's some kind of McVay connection. Boy, it's good to be Sean. I wish I was Sean McVay's agent when it came time to do the next contract, because think about the ammunition you have. Like, every single team in the league wishes they hired my guy, you know, so what is that worth to you? Yeah, it surprises me. I thought Campbell has, and Dennis Allen, have some head coaching experience. You know, Allen has a couple of years with the Raiders. Campbell had about half a year with the Dolphins. You know, and I think it should be interesting to look at Sean Payton guys. I mean, Sean Payton was Sean McVay when Sean McVay was in high school, right? Like, this was, he was an up and coming offensive mastermind, you know, 12, 13 years ago.
Right.
And obviously it's borne itself out. I think in the case of Carmichael, I think the perception is that it's Payton's offense. Mm-hmm. And so you wonder how much Carmichael has to do with it. And then in terms of Campbell, you know, he's been like the tight ends coach, but again, he has some head coach experience. He had some interviews, and I think he's a guy that could get a job in the next couple of years. And Allen, you know, his defense. And that defense is out of style, man. Like, nobody wants to be, unless you're John Elway or, I guess, Stephen Ross, you're not even thinking defensive guys when you're thinking about hiring a head coach. I think it's crazy. I mean, I don't think the right way to hire a head coach is to say, well, he's very good at coaching quarterbacks, and he'll be good with our quarterback. There's so much more to the job. But that's the way it went last week, and we'll see which of these guys has success and which ones aren't up to the task.
You sound skeptical.
I am. I mean, I look at, you know, guys who did a great job coach. I mean, yes, I know Frank Reich calls his plays and Matt Nagy calls his plays, but I think it's pretty clear when you look at the jobs those guys did that they have some sort of, you know, overseer type of, you know, heft. Like they definitely seem to command the whole building. McVay does that too. I mean, one thing you heard about McVay when he left Washington to take the job in L.A. was that that Washington would miss him because he was the hyper-organized one. He was kind of the one that kept the trains running on time in the building, that wasn't necessarily Jay Gruden's strength. And I think, you know, McVay's a guy that has an incredible capacity for a lot of different things, not just drawing up plays and calling plays and getting, you know, figuring out when to go for two, all that kind of stuff. I think people are underestimating Sean McVay to think that they can sort of pick a facsimile and have the same kind of success. I think people need to look bigger. The example I always look at is Anthony Lynn with the Chargers. This guy he was not an offensive play caller for very long. He was not an offensive coordinator for very long. And he doesn't sit there and call his own plays. He delegates, but he seems to have a very good handle on the overseer, CEO type of role, and he conveys that leadership quality that I think teams underestimate when they go through this process.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you think about the options that are available, you would imagine there are more people who have those leadership qualities available on the defensive side of the ball right now than the offensive side of the ball. But like you said, we will see. Certainly, we haven't even gotten started in their offseason program yet with those teams, so still a lot of time to go before we can consider evaluating those head coaches. But let's get to this game. I'm really excited. Saints-Rams is going to be a fun game. They played a really fantastic, entertaining game earlier this year, culminating in the Michael Thomas cell phone celebration that's sort of on the game's ceiling touchdown. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But let's start with just last week and what you saw in the Saints-Eagles game. I mean, were you impressed with how they played and how they came back, or did that early sort of struggle to, you know, they went down 14-0 against the Eagles, did that give you some pause, some reason for concern?
Well, at the time that it was happening, it did, because you thought that this sort of Nick Foles spell was going to continue another week. But no, I think you look at the whole game, and it says a lot about the Saints that they took those two early punches and recovered from it, that the defense buckled down, especially after Sheldon Rankins went out of the game. Big loss for them, and it could show up again this week, as I'm sure we'll discuss. But the defense locked it down, and the offense figured it out. And I think, you know, the figuring it out, again, we talk about coaches, it's the figuring it out that where success lies. And I think the Saints are a team that is deep enough and strong enough in so many areas of their roster that they're equipped to figure out the problem even as the game is going along. And I think they made the right adjustments, and I think, you know, you evaluate it based on the whole game. They did enough to win. Now, they kick a field goal to go up six, and they give Foles back the ball, and you're thinking, oh, my goodness, we've seen this before. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until the last interception that you felt, you know, if you're a Saints fan, you felt good about it. But, you know, the final score is the final score. It's the old Jim Valvano survive in advance theory, and the Saints are hopeful that that was their worst playoff game of the year.
Yeah, and I think realistically, they haven't really taken much criticism for the decision to run the ball on third down in advance of that field goal try, and because, you know, of what happened next with the interception. Of course, they'd be taking flack for it had it not worked out the same way, but I thought Sean Payton did a very good job in that game in terms of, you know, the fake punt was a really gutsy call, and it worked. And the, you know, not settling for the field goal on fourth down. I think it was fourth and goal from the 2 yard line. You know, down 14-0. Yeah. I think a lot of coaches would have been comfortable saying, "Hey, we made it this far. We haven't done anything on offense. Let's just take 3 points, and we'll worry about getting a lead later." And he didn't. He went forward in fourth and two, got it on that fake screen and corner out to Keith Kirkwood, and really sort of, you know, help turn the tide of that game. So I do think that Sean Payton overall, I think, did a pretty good job of coaching his way, like you said, out of that rut, making adjustments, and figuring out something to win that football game.
We're looking at a man who onside kicked.
Yes.
In the second half of a Super Bowl, to open the second half of a Super Bowl against Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts, and that worked out. So it's not new to us that Sean Payton sort of has a knack for knowing when to take the chance. Mm-hmm. But he also has the team. And I think that's the key. this is a man coaching with a great deal of confidence, and it's confidence born of his own success in the league. Mm-hmm. But it's also confidence born of what he has on his roster. If they run the ball on third down, part of the reason is they think they might be able to get it, that they have big play running backs, that they don't need to throw the ball in order to pick up a big chunk of yardage. And obviously, it's, you know, you're hoping that the other team guesses pass in a situation that sort of traditionally screams for pass. But I think Sean Payton believes that his roster can do a wide variety of things to win a game. And therefore, that expands the list of things you're willing to try that might be a little bit unconventional off the beaten path. So I think you have an aggressive, creative coach armed with the kind of team that lends itself to you know, that kind of coach using all his aggressive, creative tendencies and powers.
That's, it's interesting you say that, Dan, because I feel kind of confused about how Sean McVay managed that game last week, because he has a great, an incredible offense, a really talented running game that was dominating the Cowboys. Obviously, they're a team that everyone is scared of them going for it on fourth and short. And yet, early in that game, he punts on fourth and one. And then he goes for it at 23-15 with 7 minutes left in the game when a field goal puts them up 11 points with 7 minutes to go. And I'm not horrified by that decision, but I don't understand why you do one, not do the other. Then they tried to draw the Cowboys offside for some reason, call a timeout, come back, run the ball, score. He challenged on the Michael Gallup catch where there was no real evidence besides his players saying, hey, you know, throw the flag, challenge this on that deep pass to Gallup. So I'm really, I'm sort of confused. And I feel like even though these are two great coaches and they're regarded rightly as brilliant offensive minds, I think the Saints may have an advantage in terms of the game management aspect of this versus the relatively inexperienced McVay.
Yeah, I think experience matters a lot. And Sean McVay and the Rams can absolutely win this game. He's a good enough coach. He's got a good enough team. There's no question if the Rams win this game, you're not going to be sitting there stunned on Sunday night. However, experience does matter. And Sean Payton's coached a lot more of these games than Sean McVay has. And when you watch Sean McVay on Saturday night, I thought he looked like a guy who was feeling a great deal of pressure. Imagine the Rams losing that game.
Right.
And all you've heard for 2 years about Sean McVay is genius, next big thing, blah, 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 blah. Now he's 0-2 in the playoffs with that team. Now all of a sudden this conversation about Sean McVay is going to have a little bit of a turn, right? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we're going to be wondering, does he have what it takes to win these games? So I think he's a guy that since the beginning of the season, since training camp, when I visited their training camp late July, it felt to me like this was a team that knew that it had expectations and was, you know, and knew that there was tremendous pressure to meet them. And they won, what, their first 9 games, 10 games of the season, 8 games, something. And so obviously that validated everything. They wobble a little bit in the second half, and now Todd Gurley's hurt, and now he's playing hurt. In the middle of that offensive line is kind of like, just hold it together for a few more weeks, guys. And Talib was out for a while, and Cooper Kupp is out, and you know, when I say what the Saints have in terms of their roster, I think the Rams, you know, their roster is obviously excellent, but there are some pockets of it where they have reason to kind of worry. And I think, you know, the level of confidence Sean McVay has is very high, but you're dealing with narrow margins when we're talking about this time of year. Sean Payton's confidence is probably higher due to his experience level, due to the fact that he's playing at home, and due to the fact that his team is probably in better shape than Los Angeles right now in terms of, you know, roster and health. So again, narrow margins. You know, there a million teams would trade the Rams for their problems. But I think when you talk about that kind of edge, Payton having won Super Bowls, having coached more playoff games, having coached longer, therefore experienced more in-game situations that require quick reactions. Yeah, there's no question that that favors New Orleans in a situation like this.
Yeah, I think so. And this is a game where there's not a big margin. This is a game where the Vegas odds basically say it's a 3.5-point line. Basically, these two teams would be, there'd be a half point of a difference on a neutral field, and the Saints have home field advantage. That's going to make them the favorites. But I mean, this is a close game, and that could be the difference between these teams winning and losing these games. And I wonder if it's not that, I wonder if it's going to be one of the star players on either side of these games just being so dominant that they could make a difference, end up being the people who sort of single-handedly win this game. And to some extent, that already happened with Michael Thomas twice this year, and that was against the these very Rams earlier this year when he had 211 yards, 12 catches and a touchdown. And then last week, he was dominant against the Eagles, where he was converting, you know, third and 20 or third and 15 seemingly on a regular drive-by-drive basis. So the thing I'm going to ask you is this. In the first game where he had 211 and a touchdown, had the cell phone celebration, no Aqib Talib. It was Marcus Peters and Troy Hill at cornerback. Talib is back. Obviously, he's older. He's not necessarily the same guy he might have been years ago, but do you think Talib makes a massive difference in terms of how they cover Michael Thomas and how they're able to slow down Michael Thomas? And do you think Michael Thomas has to have a big game for the Saints to win?
I don't think Michael Thomas needs to have a big game for the Saints to win, because I think the Saints can win running the ball, and you can run the ball on the Rams. Mm-hmm. They allowed over more than 5 yards per carry in a regular season. That's where they're vulnerable. So I think if it comes to that, they can win it with Ingram and Kamara. In terms of the coverage, I'm fascinated to see what they do, because, mm-hmm. yes, Thomas is far and away the most dangerous threat in the passing game, outside of maybe Kamara, that the Saints have. Everybody else is basically an undrafted dude that Breeze is just turning into, you know, gold, because mm-hmm. he's Breeze. But, you know, they don't really have tight end. They do some weird things with Taysom Hill. But Thomas is the guy. Like, he's the guy they lean on, and we saw that in the first game against the Rams, and we saw it last week. I think he's got 7 games this year with 10 or more catches. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the guy that deserves their attention. Do they put Talib on him? Does Talib's presence allow them to change up coverages? I mean, Marcus Peters wants some of this. Like, mm-hmm. he got smoked, right? That 73-yard game winner, that was him. And then Peyton trolled him after the game, saying they loved the matchup. And Peters said, I want to see Sean Payton again and have a bowl of gumbo. And, I mean, Marcus Peters is probably begging Sean McVay and Wade Phillips to let him cover Michael Thomas so he can show that he can do it. But, of course, as a coach, you have to assess whether the guy can really handle it. And if Talib's the better matchup, or if just Talib being on the field allows them to do things that confuse or challenge Michael Thomas in a way they couldn't in the first game, you know, that would be to their benefit. So I think that's a key thing I'll have my eye on as I'm watching from the extremely remote vantage point that is the New Orleans Superdome press box on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I think it gives them options, which is exciting, right? Because now they don't have to rely on Peters or Hill single-handedly. You know, they don't have to worry about, hey, if they put Thomas on Peters' side of the field, and we have no solution because we're not going to move Troy Hill and have him shadow Michael Thomas. He's not that caliber of cornerback. Aqib Talib is that caliber of cornerback. So they have that option of mixing things up if they're so inclined, which I think is good. I think just having options is good. Yeah. I don't know what they're going to do necessarily, but on the flip side of this matchup, you watched that Saints-Eagles game last week, Andres Pete really struggled, and after the game it came out, oh, by the way, he had a broken hand and he had surgery, which, you know, if I stub my toe, I'm not very good at my job. My job does not involve my toes.
Offensive linemen are a different breed.
They're a different breed. But even among linemen, Aaron Donald is a different breed relative to other linemen on either side of the ball. And now we have Aaron Donald playing against a clearly compromised, not 100%, Andres Pete. So is that a matchup where you think that could single-handedly turn this game towards the Rams?
It could. And because when we've seen the Rams play in big games this year, I think we've seen, you know, Donald do that. And, I mean, I look back to the Monday night game against the Chiefs, which is obviously famous for the number of points that were scored in it, only game in NFL history where each team scored 50. You know, Aaron Donald's strip sack turned that game mm-hmm. in favor of the Rams, right? I mean, that was like the plays he made on defense and Samson Ebukam picking up the ball and running it in. Like that, without those, the Chiefs win. So what, you know, that's the key if you're the Saints. Let's keep Aaron Donald from wrecking the game. Because if you have to go toe-to-toe with Breeze versus Goff or Kamara versus Gurley and it's offense, 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 and whoever has the ball last wins, Donald's the kind of guy who has shown us he can make enough plays to swing that in his favor. I covered their game in Detroit where they clinched the division, and they were not playing well. And then out of nowhere in the fourth quarter, here comes Aaron Donald forcing a fumble on Matt Stafford, and the whole thing swings the Rams' way. Like, this is why he belongs in the MVP conversation, because, you know, he's at his best when the game needs him most. He's also got this uncanny ability to sort of vanish and then reappear in the backfield as soon as the snap is taken, which is really frustrating to Andres Pete and anybody else who's tried to block him all year. But, yeah, I think he's the one to watch. And I don't know how you give your interior guys help on Aaron Donald, right. But Dominican Sue is the other, is the other guy to watch. I mean, that's a major problem. And, Pete is going to have to, load up on Advil or whatever if he's going to endure that for an entire game with a busted hand.
That's going to be a lot of Advil. I don't know.
Advil might be a euphemism in this case, yes. But we can get into that in another podcast down the road.
That is another topic altogether. Yeah, and I mean, Teron Armstead's not 100% either. We saw him struggle a bit against Michael Bennett in that game last week.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's going to be a concern. I don't know that it's going to necessarily, I don't know that it's going to happen, but it wouldn't shock me by all means if Aaron Donald had an enormous game here. And on the flip side of the ball, Aaron Donald is healthy and playing great at defensive tackle, but the Saints are down one after losing Sheldon Rankins to a torn Achilles last week. And the Eagles did not run the ball well in the absence of Sheldon Rankins. They also lost Brandon Brooks, one of their excellent guards, to a torn Achilles in the same game, right around, I think, the same drive might have been the case even.
Yeah, that was weird.
Very strange. But we've seen the Rams over the past few weeks really commit to running the football. And we saw it in week 16 and week 17 with C.J. Anderson, and now we're seeing it with the combination of C.J. Anderson and Todd Gurley at running back. So after the game last week, all the Rams said was, hey, we're a physical team. We're going to show teams that this is what we're getting back to. We're getting back to our core strengths of running the football. So number one, do you think that's a real thing, that the Rams are really a run-heavy team as opposed to being sort of a team built around the pass? And number two, do you think that's their best strategy to try to win this game, is to run the ball really well at a Saints team missing their best interior run defender?
Well, Bill, when you have a weapon like C.J. Anderson, right? I mean, a guy who, who's been on, I think, four or five different rosters in the last 12 months. I mean, obviously an extremely popular player who's done a lot of great things. Look, I don't know. When they signed Anderson, I asked somebody, is this because they're worried about Gurley? And the answer was yes, and Gurley had to miss the next couple of games, so Anderson got the ball. They did not expect C.J. Anderson to run the ball like this. But now that he has, they wisely have decided to make him part of the game plan. And they felt like the way to attack the Dallas defense, which likes to come at you off the edge, was, pound it up the middle with Anderson and Gurley. And, Gurley's not 100%, and Anderson is. Looks like he's been eating well. things are, they're able to sort of 1-2 it with those guys. Now, are they going to be able to do that against the Saints? I mean, look, I think the Rams, the interior of the Rams' offensive line is probably a little weaker than their tackle spots. And, I think the Saints can probably commit some guys to that middle, cover up the center and guards a little bit and guard against the run. But, as you mentioned, the Rams can be dangerous throwing the ball as well. It's just, to me, I think the emergence of Anderson as a viable option not only helps them give Gurley a break when he needs it, but also now, they ran the ball 48 times last week against the Cowboys. So to be able to do that at a time when not a lot of people have seen you do that is obviously to your advantage. And then you look at, the Cooper Kupp injury, I think, did have a very negative effect on the Rams' passing game.
Sure.
They tried to move Robert Woods into the slot, and, Josh Reynolds was not quite the same kind of weapon on the outside. So they've kind of had to mix and match a little bit in the passing game. They get the tight ends involved from time to time, but they haven't really had a consistently dominant, passing game plan week to week like we were used to seeing them have. So I think they now have this ability to run the ball that maybe is even beyond what they thought they had initially, and so they're leaning on it. I would expect them to try and do it because, if nothing else, you keep that Saints offense on the sideline a little longer, and as fun as it may be to play in, 55 to 52 shootouts, it's not the safest way to try and win a playoff game. So I would expect to see them maybe not 48 times, but I think they're going to try and run it on the Saints and try and get control of the game that way.
Yeah, Cooper Kupp, to your point, 106.9 passer rating for Jared Goff since the beginning of 2017 with Cooper Kupp on the field, 90.9 with Cooper Kupp off the field, a 16-point difference in terms of his passer rating. With regards to Anderson, obviously it's very exciting to see a player with that sort of body type succeed. It harkens back to the glory days of Mike Tolbert, Jerome Bettis, and in a Rams uniform even. Really exciting to see. But it's fascinating to me because you think about these two matchups here. And on one hand, I've seen people say, well, you know, listen, there's a bunch of first-round picks at running back on these rosters. You have Todd Gurley, of course, with the Rams. You have Mark Ingram with the Saints. You have Sony Michel with the Patriots. Yeah. On the flip side of that, think about these teams. You have C.J. Anderson, who was on the street in Week 16, who the Raiders said, not for us. We're good. We don't need to worry about that. And he's playing a meaningful role and looks, by the numbers, better than Todd Gurley has been over the course of this season with the Rams. Now, I'm not saying he's as good as Todd Gurley, but at the very least, not physically, but on in terms of performance, relatively similar in terms of his stature. You think about the Saints. Well, it's not Mark Ingram is playing the big role. It's Alvin Kamara, who is a, believe, a second-round pick, a third-round pick, certainly not a first-round pick in the offense, who's making less than $1 million a year, I believe, this year. The Patriots, again, it's James White, who was a mid-round pick. And for the Chiefs, it's Damian Williams, who was a guy with the Dolphins. I mean, it wasn't exactly like he was someone who people were desperate to add to their roster, who has not been maybe as good as Kareem Hunt, but has been pretty close and has certainly not slowed the Chiefs' offense down at all. So do you think teams are going to take away the, oh, these teams are first-round picks, we need to devote more resources to running back? Or do you think they're going to say, hey, we can get by with a guy who's making basically nothing at this position. Maybe let's not put so much of a focus on running backs in the years to come.
I mean, but how many times have we gone over this as it pertains to, like, the Giants and Saquon Barkley, right? I mean, like, this is – how are the Jaguars feeling about number four overall pick Leonard Fournette right now, right? How are the Cowboys going to feel about number four overall pick Ezekiel Elliott in a year or two when he wants a Todd Gurley-level contract extension? And, you know, these guys are great players. Well, Elliott is at least. Gurley is certainly. Barkley is certainly. But financially, it doesn't make any sense to draft a backup there. And that's why I think, you know, it won't change. Mm-hmm. I think there will be an exception every now and then where a guy goes really high because a team feels like they're that player away, whether they're correct in the case of Dallas or completely kidding themselves in the case of the Giants. There will be teams that draft because they think that's the key difference maker for them. Mm-hmm. But you're still going to find Alvin Kamara in the third, you know, Kareem Hunt in the third, whatever else happened. He was a productive player before the off-the-field stuff. You know, Philip Lindsay didn't get drafted at all. He's in the Pro Bowl. Like, what do you – you don't need to do it. So, I don't know. I mean, I think teams are going to continue to try and mine those middle and late rounds for their running back help. Mm-hmm. There will be spectacular players that will appeal, that will be like – teams will convince themselves this guy's too good not to take here as an overall football player, as it was the case with Barkley last year. But, no, I don't see a change. And I think, you know, the Gurley contract, whatever Le'Veon Bell gets – whatever Zeke gets, and it's going to push the running back market up a little bit, but I still don't see teams being comfortable committing major resources to a position that has such a short shelf life and is so fragile. And I think Kamara is a fascinating case. Right. He's a third-round pick, no fifth-year option, making less than $1 million each of the next 2 years, one of the best players in the league. If there's a guy you look at and say, this is the next Le'Veon Bell, this is the next guy that would actually think about sitting out a season in order to get what he's worth, that might be the guy, because he is drastically underpaid for his role and is going to continue to be. And then they'll be able to franchise him and keep him under control until such time as, you know, he may be too worn down to help.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting to a sort of similar point, but not necessarily exactly the same. Of course, Anderson, like I said, a guy who was on the street a couple of weeks ago on the Rams side of the ball. The Saints, meanwhile, they traded for Eli Apple in midseason, who, I mean, last year basically looked like he was about to get cut by the Giants. Former first-round pick, but guy who was, you know, kind of seen as replaceable this year. He was traded around the trade deadline to the Saints, and he basically has become a starting cornerback almost immediately for them and played pretty well. Do you think, in general, as fans, as analysts, as reporters, as journalists, do you think we're too aggressive about sort of accounting for guys and sort of treating them as how they look in this, in the particular situation they're currently in, as opposed to sort of thinking about, well, if they end up in the right situation, they might succeed? Or are those guys more sort of exceptions to the rule?
I think, you know, it's exceptions, but I mean, roster depth plays such a big, important role at this time of year, right? I mean, everybody's dealing with injuries. So how have you corrected your problems? And I think, you know, some teams are going to take flyers on guys and it's not going to work out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some teams are going to find a C.J. Anderson. And, I mean, look, the Rams were in a situation, That Detroit game I referenced, they lost Malcolm Brown, who was Gurley's top backup, and a guy that they trusted in pass protection, and a guy that could have filled in for Gurley if he had gotten hurt. You know, they didn't have that anymore. So Anderson fills that role. He's not the first guy they brought in to try and fill it. He's the one that clicked. But, I think this goes back to the whole issue of sort of puzzle solving. And I think the Rams would tell you they got lucky. I don't think there's any way they expected C.J. Anderson to produce like he has for them. They believed it was a stopgap, a veteran, a guy who could pick up a blitz and could, eat up some carries. Mm-hmm. Remember, at the time, the games he was supposed to play in were not meaningful games.
Right.
Like, the Rams had everything locked up. They just sort of needed somebody to carry the ball for them because they were low on guys. And Gurley wasn't going to be able to play. So they get to the divisional playoff round. Well, this guy's playing pretty well. Let's get him in a game plan. So I think that's... I think that's a lucky break, but you need some of those. And, luck is the residue of design to a certain extent. It's also the residue, in this case, of activity. You sit on your hands and say, well, we've clinched everything. Our backup running backs are enough to get us through. We'll just sit with what we have versus, well, let's add a guy who might be able to give us something more than that. Now, all of a sudden, you've given yourself a chance to find that diamond in the rough.
Yeah. So in terms of this game on the whole, what do you think would be the most entertaining outcome as someone who's not rooting for either team? I'm assuming you're not. I know I'm not. I just want to see an entertaining game. Would a close Rams game be better? A close Rams win, I should say. A close Saints win? Or a blowout Saints win? Or a blowout Rams win? What would be the most entertaining outcome of the four to you?
Well, one of the close ones. I mean, blowouts are no fun, right? There's not another game to watch. You're stuck, right? It's like you had Patriots-Chargers the other day and you wanted to switch to another game. You couldn't. So, no. I would say close. Maybe close Rams win. I'd
really?
Say the Rams. They bring an element of calamity to the whole thing that I think is... I think a close Saints win might look a little bit like the Eagle game the other day. And while that was exciting... the Saints are supposed to win it, and then now they're at home, and they're sort of the more, I think they're sort of the more clinical operation. Whereas I think the Rams, something spectacular is more likely to have happened to produce a close Rams win. So, it could be an Aaron Donald strip sack, right? Or Brandon Cooks going 80 yards, or, Gurley breaking off a monster 50-yard touchdown run or something like that. So, I mean, to your impossible question, which requires an answer, I would say I'm going to go ahead and say Rams win for that reason. You ask me again tomorrow, I might have a different answer.
I feel like it's more entertaining to see the Saints fans happy in New Orleans.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. The party will be better. Yeah,
I feel like the party will be better. So I would say I'm going to lean towards narrow Saints win. But I think parties can disagree on this matter. Dan, if you have to pick... what would you pick if this is the final outcome? It might change between now and Sunday, but what would you actually pick for the outcome of this game?
I'd pick the Saints. I pick the Saints to win the Super Bowl in August. At this point, there's no reason to go off of them. They're at home. They've been the best team all year. I think I have the Saints winning this game.
I appreciate you sneaking that one in, that you mentioned that you were on this bandwagon in August.
Right? I don't often. My Super Bowl team is not often still playing in the third week of January. That's not a. It's usually a kiss of death. So the Saints have. Talk about overcoming obstacles. I mean, the Saints have overcome a significant one there to still be alive after I picked them.
3-1.
Chargers didn't make it.
Yeah, well, 3-1 last week. The one pick you did not get correct was the Los Angeles Chargers. But on a hot streak. 1-3 out of the last four. I have faith you might be right this Sunday, Dan Graziano. When people want to perhaps comment on how correct you were, where can they do that? Where can they follow more of what you do?
Well, I'm on Twitter, obviously, at Dan Graziano ESPN. People can yell at me there, and often do. But what do we got going on this week? I didn't write too much. We did our best and worst free agent signings from last year. That posted yesterday on ESPN.com.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I'm scheduled to write again until column off the game Sunday night. So you can check that out. And no more TV this week. I'm actually taking a little breather, spending some time at home, reconnecting with my wife and kids.
Wow.
It's nice. But I'm off to New Orleans on Saturday.
Well, just like every NFL coach who says they're going to retire to spend more time with their family and then a few days later decide, actually, I wouldn't mind that head coaching job somewhere else. You'll be off to New Orleans doing great work for us here at ESPN. Just like that. Just like that. 10. Always a pleasure. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show and Field Yates talking about the AFC game here after the break. Back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Joined now, making his return to the show. Very excited to welcome back ESPN's Field Yates to talk about the Patriots-Chiefs conference championship game to come. Field, how are you?
Bill, I think I might be on the wrong podcast.
I was told
we were going to be doing a look into NFL free agency. No, I kid. I'm doing great, and it's always good to catch up.
It's always great to have you on. I will say I have a question I have been asked to ask you based on the previous conversation I had earlier in the show with Dan Graziano. We were wondering, Field Yates, do you know how to play the guitar?
I do not know how to play the guitar. Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint. I can't wait to listen to what you and Dan talked about to see just how much I've let you down. I come from a background of zero musical experience, and I'm tone deaf. But I've got great courage when it comes to singing. So I think long and hard about my vocal ability, and then I realize I have none and still pretend like I have some. So which should bode well for when I get married in about 5 months. Well, or poorly. We'll be the judge of that this summer.
We will be the judge of that summer, indeed. I had faith in you. I had faith that you had picked it up somewhere along the way, just casually, just thought, hey, I should learn the guitar. And then in 2 weeks, suddenly you were a virtuoso. But
man, I let you down.
It's okay. It's okay. We will get to more important topics. We'll get to this Patriots-Chiefs game. And we'll get to, apparently, the coldest weather that has ever colded when it comes to an NFL game before. Field, how do you think the Arctic blast, or whatever it's been called, that is going to descend upon Arrowhead Stadium on Sunday is actually going to impact this Patriots-Chiefs game?
It's so funny you ask that, Bill, because as I am sitting here, I happen to have my tweet deck open, and our buddy Evan Silva, who does a great job covering all things football at RotoWorld, posted a link to an article from Warren Sharp, who is really one of the more unique thinking football minds out there right now in the media, about how the game temperature is already climbing, and we're looking at something closer to 20 degrees on Sunday. It's one of those days that is the outlier in the sense that the warmest temperature might come around 5 or 6 p.m. local time. The game, of course, kicks off at 5:40 p.m. So let's put it this way. It's going to be cold. Like, it's not like we're going to see a bunch of people that are sane in the stands that are out there in polo shirts and, you know, shorts. It's going to be people in sleeping bags and standing on cardboard boxes and a lot of Canada Goose. Good day for the Canada Goose sponsorship to rear itself on Sunday afternoon. In terms of how it actually impacts the game, Bill, is two things. First of all, and I know that people, this is a hard thing to quantify, but it's one more thing that things are, that players are thinking about going into the game. And I've been around this. The funny part, this is sort of the Field Yates Bowl, at least I'm calling it that myself, because in my formative days prior to ESPN, the two places that I worked were the Patriots and the Chiefs.
Right.
So I have certainly been, you know, I was not a prominent part, but a teeny tiny part of each of those organizations. And seeing them, you know, believe it or not, it's often cold in Kansas City, and believe it or not, it's often cold in Foxborough, Massachusetts. So I've been a part of these atmospheres where the games are a little bit cold on game day, and it's one more thing that players are thinking about in terms of what it actually means. So just when you're going through your prep, it's, do I have the right cleats on based off how hard the field is? Do I want to wear sleeves? Do I want to tough it out and not want to wear sleeves? If you're a quarterback, do you want to wear gloves? If you're a wide receiver, do you want to find an insulated glove? If you're an offensive lineman, are you too tough to wear sleeves, but instead you have a tub of Vaseline on you, which is like the oldest trick in the book. A lot of people who ski know that as well. Put it on your face, can sort of create a layer. But in terms of the actual football side of it, Bill, I think that, you know, drops are something I'm keeping an eye on. It's just harder to catch a football when you have little to no feelings in your hands. And then, you know, ball security as runners go as well, right? I mean, the less feeling you have of the football in your arm when you're carrying it, the more likely you are to, you know, not realize how close it is to being jarred away from you. So I think that, ball security and drops are the two ways that it really rears itself. Like, it's going to be cold, but at some point adrenaline will carry over. And we all know they have like these massive, almost like fire pits on the sidelines that just blast heat towards players. So those are the areas, like, so during the in between plays, like, I think guys will mostly be fine. plays themselves, I think ball security is really the area that I'm keeping the closest eye on.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Phil, because I was just thinking about what I was going to ask you next was going to be the Chiefs running back situation, because you think about the two games these two teams have played over the past 2 years, two really exciting games. Week one of 2017, the Chiefs victory against that Patriots team in the opener, and then earlier this year, Patriots, I think 43-40 victory over the Chiefs in a very exciting game. And one of the stars of both those games was Kareem Hunt, who, of course, famously fumbled, I think, on his first NFL touch in the first quarter of week one in 2017.
Very first one, yeah.
Yes, and then had a big game afterwards, and then played a very big role in this game earlier this year. And that was as a receiver. He did well as a runner, but he had five catches for 98 yards and two scores in week one of 2017 as a receiver, five catches for 105 yards and a touchdown in week six of 2018 as a receiver. So he is not available, obviously, for off-field reasons, not on the roster anymore. There is Damian Williams in that role, who has been, I think, more effective than I was expecting, given how he played with the Dolphins, but that's mostly been as a runner. Do you think Damian Williams, given the conditions, given that he does not have necessarily the same receiving capabilities that Kareem Hunt does, do you think he can make an impact on this game as a receiver that might be similar to what Kareem Hunt has done in the past for the Chiefs against the Patriots?
Yeah, I think that he can make an impact as a receiver, Bill, but I will just say this. When the topic is brought up in advance of a game of, like, how do you slow down X player, or what is this team's game plan? Mm-hmm. I think to encapsulate it in just one answer is obviously oversimplifying the process. I mean, the Patriots and Chiefs have spent, or will spend, you know, 48 to 72 hours to develop their initial game plan, mm-hmm. and it'll be fine-tuned and tinkered leading up to Sunday. And every single play has many a nuance that each player on the field might be in some way impacted by. But I do think, just speaking incredibly generally, that the Patriots would probably feel most comfortable. Like, if they are going to be a team that loses to the Chiefs on Sunday, mm-hmm. if they had their way, their, like, outcomes they could live by in a losing effort, and the answer is you don't want to lose, period. But it's, we find a way to not let Tyreek Hill change the game suddenly. If you recall when the Patriots and Chiefs last played, it was 24-9 at halftime. And the Chiefs scored immediately to open the third quarter, and it was a long Kareem Hunt from Patrick Mahomes pass, not even a run, mm-hmm. a pass. It was like 70 or so yards, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, things got tight. When the game was finally tied again in the fourth quarter, it was a one-play, 70-yard touchdown that was a Tyreek Hill play, mm-hmm. Of course, 75-yard touchdown, I should say, and so my point is this, is that Tyreek Hill and when Kareem Hunt was on the roster, to me, were the two players that had the most ability based off of speed and explosiveness to create a sudden change play. Mm-hmm. And I think while you can't necessarily, you know, budget to not have any of those, that's what you're trying to eliminate if you're the Patriots. Damian Williams has been really good, as you said. I mean, good enough to earn a new contract right on the final day of the regular season. But I still think if the Patriots are going to say, hey, if we're going to lose this game on Sunday, we'd probably sleep easier if it were Damian Williams that was the best player on the field for the Chiefs, as opposed to Tyreek Hill, but Travis Kelce was the next man up, that they probably say, we've got to find a way to neutralize him.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about next, actually. See, you're setting me, you're such a podcast professional, you're setting me up for all these follow-up questions that I want to ask you. My feeling, I don't remember where I read this, and I could certainly be wrong, and if anyone's going to correct me on this, it's going to be you. I feel like when the Patriots have a really scary tight end on the other side of the field from them, and they're on defense, I think Bill Belichick's strategy is basically, we want to take that tight end out of the game, because, you know, if it is someone like Zach Ertz, who did have a pretty good game against the Patriots in the Super Bowl, but if it's someone against Zach Ertz, he can contribute so much in the run game as a blocker and so much as a passer that we want to not worry about that tight end taking advantage of our players. And in these two games that we're talking about, he's been not quiet, but by Travis Kelce standards, he has not really changed those games. He had five catches for 40 yards in the first one, and then most recently a little more. He was 5 of 9 for 61 yards. So 101 yards over two games, less than he would normally do. But Tyreek Hill has had monster games. He had three touchdowns, 142 yards in week six of this year, and then 133 and a touchdown in week one of 2017. So from the Patriots' perspective, do you think it is more – like, do you think Tyreek Hill should be the first person they are thinking about on every single play? Or should it be Kelce and thinking, well, we're going to worry about Tyreek Hill, and he might only make an impact for a play or two here or there, hopefully?
I think it should be Tyreek Hill on every single play. And here's the reason why, is that from a square footage standpoint, Tyreek Hill's real estate is 100 yards of the field vertically, yes, and 53 and a third yards horizontally, which is the width of the NFL field. Mm-hmm. While Travis Kelce is amazing, Bill, and I would argue that he was the best tight end in football, and that's not like – that's not particularly bold of a claim.
No.
But still, in a year when we had three awesome tight ends, Zach Ertz and obviously George Kittle as well, like Travis Kelce was the best tight end in the field almost every single week that he played for the Chiefs this season.
Right.
And he can do about as much as any tight end can do. But still, the area that you are likely accounting for with Travis Kelce is somewhere, it's basically the inside of the numbers on one side or the inside of the numbers on the other side. So, you know, that's about two-thirds of the horizontal space on the field. Whereas with Tyreek Hill, Bill, first of all, he can line up anywhere.
Right.
Second of all, before the snap, he's going to be something you're going to have to account for. The Chiefs have all this window dressing pre-snap, which makes a defense have to react in a lot of different ways. And sometimes defenses lose the play before the ball is even snapped because they can't keep up with what Kansas City is doing prior to the snap that's going to impact the result of that play. Tyreek Hill, you're going to see him in motion. You're going to see him in the backfield. You're going to see him squatting in the backfield. We're almost like, hey, maybe linebackers don't see that he's hiding behind Mitch Morse or you know, Mitchell Schwartz or Eric Fisher or LDT, the Chiefs guard, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, who's back off of IR this week. So, like, there are a lot of different ways that Tyreek Hill can hurt you. And I'm not saying that you ever want to relinquish points, Bill, but there is something just entirely demoralizing about a long run after catch or a play where the wide receiver just gets behind you. I don't mean necessarily blown coverage like we saw from the Patriots in that Keenan Allen touchdown at the beginning of last week. Like, that looked like a mental error to me, right?
Unless,
that was just like, hey, I didn't slough in cover three when I had to keep dropping. I had to keep staying vertical. Like, that's on me. I think, it, you know, my guess was that was a Stephon Gilmore mental error. But when you just can't keep up with the guy, Bill, or when a guy catches the football and dashes and you can't keep up with him, which was the example of that 75-yard play, you come to the sideline and you're just like, listen, coach, whoever, whether it's Bill Belichick, Brian Flores, whoever it is that you are addressing in that circumstance, it's like, I'm not sure what to tell you. Like, we're the right place, the right coverage. Like, he's just faster than us.
Right.
So I think it's like, I think you'd feel better about, you know, small gashes here or there from Travis Kelce than you would a few different Tyreek Hill plays where even if he has three catches, like if one of those three is for 75 yards and a touchdown, think about how much that does, not just to the defense, but also the crowd at Arrowhead, which is going to be a factor on Sunday.
Given that Tyreek Hill is going to be in motion so frequently and you're going to, it's going to be so difficult for you to say, okay, you know, when you're doubling someone like Tyreek Hill, you have to communicate so well because you have, you know, you might be passing him off to a guy on the other side of the field if you're playing zone, or if you're, you know, if you're having someone follow him in man and having support behind him, well, that guy has to catch up in man and he might not be able to follow Tyreek Hill across the field horizontally before the snap. I mean, how do you, what do you think the optimal strategy is for the Patriots in this game and how they deal with Tyreek Hill? Are you just doubling him every single play with, you know, J.C. Jackson, Devin McCourty over the top? Are you putting Stephon Gilmore on him and then giving him help over the top? Like, what do you do to stop Tyreek Hill if you're going to think about it?
Thinking back to this first matchup, if I'm not mistaken, Bill, most of the day, Stephon Gilmore, who has a case at least as the best cornerback in football this season, I know I just brought up his error last week, but part of the reason why that was so shocking was because it was so infrequent this season and he eventually picked off Phillip Rivers.
Right.
He's been remarkable this year.
Yes.
But the Patriots largely utilized him to shadow Sammy Watkins in that first matchup. Now, that was a different part of the year, right? This was all the way back in October, and you know, the maybe the impact of Tyreek Hill at that point was significant, but it's only grown to be more significant over the 10 or 12 weeks since. But I don't know that the Patriots would view Tyreek Hill as the kind of player that Stephon Gilmore matches up with, because I think part of what makes Gilmore so effective is great footwork, great discipline, understanding of leverage. also the ability to, not that he's going to overwhelm you with physicality like Jalen Ramsey, right, but be physical at the line of scrimmage, whereas J.C. Jackson, the player that you mentioned, Bill, is a little bit more vertical, but he's really fast. And I think that probably the, again, to oversimplify things, it's J.C. Jackson and Devin McCourty, and essentially playing 9-on-10 offense or defense otherwise on the field, because it just takes one play for a mental error, a miscommunication, a loss of leverage for Tyreek Hill to be on the other side, in the end zone, I should say. And I think there's a pretty easy – he's the only guy in this game, Bill, that represents that, right? I mean, the Patriots were awesome offensively last week, but the Patriots really don't have a player right now that, you know, if you're the Chiefs, you are – counting on or fearful of a 75-yard touchdown score. Like, that's just not how this offense is utilized right now.
Absolutely. And on the topic of the Patriots offense, of course, they have their own issues they're going to present to the Chiefs defense. And Bob Sutton has struggled over the years against stopping the Patriots, and he's tried different things. In that playoff game, I believe they rushed three more often than you might figure and got burned by it. And they've had some success during the regular season with their pass rush getting to Brady, that Monday night game a couple years ago, being a key example of that, of course, years and years ago by now. But in terms of the Chiefs' perspective in this game, given what the Patriots are doing, last week we saw them go against the Chargers, who had seven defensive backs on the field for a chunk of the game, who were playing the same cover three they play typically, and they got destroyed. The Patriots chewed them up and spit them out, and the Chargers did not have a plan B to really account for that. They don't have, whether it was the personnel, whether it was the coaching, they just did not have a solution, and the Patriots were dominant on offense for the majority of the game. From the Chiefs' perspective here, if you're Bob Sutton, are you trying to mix things up to throw Tom Brady off, or do you just have to hope that your pass rush is going to win this game for you?
Yeah, I think a little bit of trying to mix things up, but I think the hope in Kansas City is, I don't know about finding a stoutness to them, if I could make up a word. What we saw with the Patriots the last time they played, Bill, was that they just tried to find a way to jam the football down the Chiefs' throats, and that meant a ton of Sony Michel and James Devlin on the field at the same time. It meant a lot of Rob Gronkowski making his impact and his mark as a blocker, not just a tight end that's catching passes, kind of what we saw this past weekend with the Patriots against the Chargers. And I think one of the misnomers of going into regular personnel, 21 personnel, is that it means you are playing slow and deliberately. Yeah, well, sure. Of course, you are more likely to have an 8-minute drive if you are running the football meticulously and doing so effectively. But we also saw that, you know, one of the realities of last week, Bill, was you had bigger bodies on defensive backs and smaller linebackers, or defensive backs that were aligned as linebackers, and the Patriots were just gashing the Chargers for 10, 12 chunk yard running plays. Mm-hmm. And in essence, the Patriots also utilized James White as an extension of the running game with his 15 catches, which was 15 more rushes than the rushes he had last. He had zero rushes last week. So I think it is, for the Patriots' mentality, is going to be, again, like, we may not have to go crazy in terms of, like, you know, pulling out the kitchen sink or a bunch of new things we haven't done before. It's going to try to be doing what we have done well and being more effective in the Chiefs' front that has been better. And I think everybody realizes the Chiefs' defense has been better than it was previously, but I still think there's a certain vulnerability to them if you are able to run the football and stay on script. And what I mean by staying on script is that the Chiefs are outstanding coming out of the gates. Yep. They're just amazing. And listen, they're amazing offensively in basically every quarter. But the Patriots know that there's a certain energy the Chiefs play with in the first quarter that can suffocate or really almost humble an opponent. And if you don't find a way to survive that initial wave, especially at home, you've got a really difficult road ahead of you. So while the Patriots probably would feel like, all things being equal, the best way to melt this Chiefs defense throughout the course of the game is to, you know, a lot of 21 personnel and a lot of what we saw last week, part of it is going to be that they can do so after, or they can do so early, and that they can keep this game from being 14-0 early against the Chiefs and having to abandon some of the plans they've laid.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that in the Colts game where the Colts were down 14-0 pretty much immediately, and their game plan, whatever it was, you would assume would have been a decent amount of running.
Went away.
Immediately went out the window, and they did not have a plan B. And the Chiefs defense, to your point, significantly better at home this year. 19.6 points allowed per game at Arrowhead, 34.6 points per game allowed on the road. And we know, I mean, no matter how cold it is, no matter how warm it is, that's not a quiet stadium. This is a team or stadium where they set the record for the loudest stadium in football during that Monday night win over the Patriots a few years ago. You know they're going to be loud when it comes to this game on Sunday. I have to imagine the Patriots at this point, it's such a familiar offense that they're not going to have any issues with that. But, I mean, do you think that's going to make an impact in terms of how they approach this game?
Well, it certainly will before the snap, right? I mean, the Patriots are so good and so proficient in their offensive operation that, you know, a lot of the communication is done non-verbally as it is, and they have been doing this for so long, and the system is essentially the same with obviously dashes and wrinkles thrown in every single week. Mm-hmm. But I think they've seen enough of these difficult to travel to stadiums over the course of the years, Bill, that they're going to be okay with their non-verbal communication and getting the ball out efficiently. And this is like sort of football nerd stuff, Bill, but one of the reasons why the Patriots have a lot of value in their center, David Andrews, mm-hmm. and this is one of those things that like you probably don't notice it until you watch it closely on a Sunday, is like they've always valued centers that can deliver a perfect shotgun snap every single snap. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason where that shows up is when you've got a hostile environment and you're having to, you know, combat noise, it's not just like, is the ball getting out before, you know, the clock hits zero, but if a center is frazzled or flustered and having to, you know, snap the ball in a rushed manner, is the ball getting to where it needs to go to? Which is often, if you look at some of the errant snaps, it's because, hey, play clock is running down, the quarterback is slapping his hands and stomping his feet, get it back. Or there's such confusion before the snap, the quarterback doesn't know the ball is coming, and the ball just breezes right by him. So I think the Patriots are pretty well equipped in order to handle the noise on Sunday. That being said, like, it just takes one play. Like, every play that has momentum generation to it, Bill, mm-hmm. is going to favor, you know, that it's one of the beauties of playing at home. That's always going to favor the Chiefs in this circumstance. Like, the more plays that have sort of quote-unquote big play to them that are likely to make SportsCenter, that are even tied to the Chiefs in a positive manner, mm-hmm. it's going to give that crowd one more chance to up the ante and try to set a new decibel record and be as rowdy as Arrowhead is proud to be. And trust me, as somebody who worked there, like, I grew up in New England, Bill, as you well know. And mm-hmm. Although you and I went to New England schools, we have a lot of pride in. We also would concede that like the atmosphere in New England college football is not necessarily like that. That like, you know, there's a reason why College Game Day is an infrequent visitor to the New England region.
Sure.
But the Arrowhead Stadium is the closest thing you'll see to a college football atmosphere. It's amazing. Like mm-hmm. 6 hours before the game, when we would get there for work, for those of us that were like working on the game on Sundays, fans would be at the gates, like lined up, like making barbecue outside of the entry point. Like you guys don't want to wait and get here like 3 hours before the game. No, it's like an all day procession. It's amazing. It's one of the most unique atmospheres in sports. And I can't imagine just how fired up everybody in Kansas City is for this upcoming Sunday.
Now I'm hungry, Field. See, you got a couple more minutes to go.
I just want to go eat. Sorry. It's lunchtime, okay. You know?
It is lunchtime. I'm a growing boy. I'm hungry. No, last question I'm going to ask you about this game. We'll get to maybe a prediction after that. But when the Patriots needed a big play the last time these two teams played, maybe not a surprise who they went to. It was Rob Gronkowski, who I think a lot of times over the years when Tom Brady has needed a big play in the fourth quarter, he's going to go to his star tight end. Last game, they had on the final drive that set up the game-winning field goal, Gronk had a big catch over, I want to say, Josh Shaw.
Ron Parker, I believe.
No, it wasn't Ron Parker. It was someone who was...
That's right. This was pre-Ron Parker era, which is now obviously over again.
Yes, Ron Parker was cut to bring back Laurent Duvernay-Tardif on the roster. It was... I can't find the guy's name, but he is no longer on the roster as well as Ron Parker, which...
Okay.
I don't want to fault him because it wasn't a really fair matchup playing Gronk one-on-one in one of the biggest situations of the day. But you get the idea. It was a backup Chiefs defensive back against a star Patriots tight end. And Rob Gronkowski, it seems like, certainly is not playing as big of a role as a receiver. He was great as a blocker last week, but has not playing as big of a role as a receiver in this game. And I'm assuming the Chiefs don't have Eric Berry, who, you know, came back but has had a recurrence of the heel pain that has prevented him from playing. He didn't play last round. If you don't have Eric Berry and you're the Chiefs, what do you worry about Rob Gronkowski in this game? Do you think he is limited enough that we don't have to treat him like he is the game-breaking superstar tight end? Or are you worried enough about him that you have to make him a priority even if he is not the guy he used to be?
I could be wrong here, Bill, but I don't know that there is a 7-catch, 122-yard, 2-touchdown game left in Gronk this season. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong there. But as you mentioned, what I would call gotta-have-it situations, the Patriots often turn to the same familiar faces, and Gronk is one of them. And you mentioned that play, and I've got the game book open here from when those two teams last played in the snaps, and I'm still not sure who it was that was in coverage of Gronk on that 29 or 39-yard catch that eventually set up a game-winning field goal, whether it was Josh Shaw. We have confirmation, by the way, that Ron Parker was with the Chiefs at that point. He actually played every snap for them on that play, so it might have been him. Who knows? But in any event, gotta have in situations, Gronk still has some effectiveness. And it's weird because I don't think, like, people have this idea that Gronk is cooked, he's toast, he's done, Bill. But wouldn't you think that it's actually more physically taxing to be a third offensive tackle for a full game like he was last week, basically, than it would be to be a tight end catching passes all over the field?
Right.
So I don't know that Gronk has it on an every single snap basis. But I do think that the Chiefs are still going to treat him like a player that has lethal weapon upside.
Yeah, I think they should. I think I'd rather be proven wrong. I'd rather sit here and say, you know what, Monday morning we lost. Chris Hogan just beat us. I mean, you know, Chris Hogan had a 140-yard game, and there's nothing we could do. Our you know, our fourth defensive back couldn't cover Chris Hogan. Getting beat by Gronk, it just doesn't feel as good. It doesn't feel as exciting. It's sort of similar to your point about Tyreek Hill, where it's demoralizing to get beat on one big play. With Gronk, it's demoralizing to get beat by a guy who, you know, is just an otherworldly freak of an athlete. And even if he's not the same guy he was, even if he's not going to be a guy who catches, you know, eight passes for 120 yards and totally takes over the game, I think in those moments on third and long in the fourth quarter, if it's a close game, on fourth down, man, I just don't want Gronk to beat me. Tom Brady can make those throws, of course, to other guys, but I'd rather trust, you know, someone else at one-on-one coverage on Chris Hogan than have Gronk, you know, singled against a backup defensive back in this game.
It's funny. The Patriots right now, in terms of usage with Gronk in the passing game, it almost looks like the inverse part of the spectrum of where he is in his career. Gronk right now in the passing game looks like the rookie who's got a ton of upside that they can't quite figure out how to use him in the passing game consistently. And he's, because, you know, he's doing great work in the running game. But it's like, yeah, like, you know, we like him in small doses. Because that catch he had last week against the Chargers, he had just one of them, one for 25 yards. Like, it was a pretty Gronkian catch. But they don't use him consistently in the passing game right now. And maybe that's just because he has so much value to them in the running game. Maybe it's because, you know, there's just wear and tear and fatigue that, for whatever reason, you know, he's more vulnerable in the open field when he can't see what's coming at him from hit standpoint. But whatever the reason, Gronk is almost like, yeah, like he's like the super talented, raw, true freshman that we have to get on the field, but we haven't quite figured out how to maximize him yet. And not that the Patriots aren't creative and innovative and arguably the best in that regard. But right now it sort of feels like where we were back in 2010 with Gronk. Alas, it's January of 2019. He is not the same player. But he's still a guy that I know defenses feel strongly about having to account for. And remember, at the beginning of the season, Bill, and maybe this is still the case, but a lot of the narrative was, like, every single play, defense are just putting two bodies on Gronk and saying, someone else is going to beat us because it is not going to be number 87.
Yeah. I mean, and I wouldn't fault them either way. I just wouldn't want to sit here Monday morning and just be sad about, you know, Gronk beating us again. It just doesn't. Can't feel good. So Field,
sure,
we're here at the end of this game. These are two organizations who are both great, who you've worked for in the past, who you have an affinity for in one way or another. Who do you think is actually going to win this game on Sunday?
Bill, I keep coming back to the Chiefs. And the reason why, and I understand that both of these teams were awesome last week. And nothing should surprise us this Sunday. But I come back to the Chiefs for a few reasons. Well, sort of one reason, right? Like, I still kind of come back to Patrick Mahomes in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. It's Patrick Mahomes, it's Tyreek Hill, it's the stadium and the atmosphere. Those are the reasons I come back. And I would love to tell you that I have, like, this great decisive feel about, like, here are the, you know, the X factors that will make the difference, Bill. And I can't, like, I'm not going to try to outsmart the masses here. There are a lot of people who have an opinion about this game this weekend, and I just look at it like push comes to shove. The Chiefs have been the best offensive team in football this year, one of the best teams we've ever seen offensively. And Patrick Mahomes, who I think will be the runaway MVP, has just been that good. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any team deserves anything in the playoffs. Like, they earn everything they get. But I think that these four teams playing on Sunday, to me, were clear-cut. Not just talent-wise, because sometimes talent is surpassed by preparedness and execution and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. I think these are the four most qualified teams in the NFL this season. I really do.
I agree. Here's the thing. Monday morning, I was talking about how the Chiefs might feel dumb. I will feel dumber if I pick against the Patriots and they win than I will if I pick against the Chiefs and they win. So I think I'm going to go with the Patriots solely for that reason alone.
It feels close. Wait, one thing that we can agree upon, by the way, Bill,
yes.
And I don't mean to get ahead of ourselves, I don't want to presume that we can agree upon this, is that there was a time this year where a narrative prevailed that the Patriots were at the end. The end is nigh here. I don't believe, and even if the Patriots go to Arrowhead and get waxed 58-0 on Sunday, that this should be viewed as the end of the road for the Patriots.
Right.
I just don't. And I think that, like, that's the only part, like, I can live with any outcome in any game this weekend. And I understand that that's going to be a narrative if the Patriots lose on Sunday. But I really think we can do better. Like, I think we can aim higher than presuming that Sunday dictates the future of whether the Patriots are going to be in the mix or not. Like, I think there's enough organizational infrastructure. Last time I checked, Tom Brady is pretty decent. And a lot of the guys that are there now are going to be there next year, and they've got 12 draft picks. Like, the Chiefs are going to be here for a long time because of Patrick Mahomes and a lot of the great things they've done with that front office, that coaching staff.
Mm-hmm.
The Patriots are not going away either. Those are two things that I think need to be very clear, regardless of the outcome on Sunday.
Yeah, this is not going to be the end for either team. The Chiefs have so much talent. Wouldn't shock me if they are they have Andy Reid, who's an annual playoff contender either way. You know, barring a major injury to Patrick Mahomes, which obviously I hope does not happen, I think they're going to be back year after year in the playoff hunt. And the Patriots, like you said, next year, first rounder, 2 second rounders, and I believe an extra third round. No, they have one third rounder.
So they traded their third to Cleveland. They have an extra in a trade, I believe, with Detroit.
Detroit, yeah.
And they are projected to land two compensatory picks, having lost both Malcolm Butler, Nate Solder, and then also later on down the line, Danny Amendola and Deion Lewis, in free agency, which, just to quickly put a bow on that point, like, if you're talking about how you know the team is built to last, like, look at how they've replaced those players and making smart decisions. That, to me, is a sign of a good free agent.
Yeah, and pretty much their entire
front office.
Yeah, and their entire draft this year pretty much got hurt. I mean, they really got very little out of their draft because so many of their players got hurt. So we're going to have next year this flood of guys who you're not even thinking about, your Isaiah Wynn, your Duke Dawson's, who might be playing meaningful roles on the roster next year. So I absolutely agree. The Patriots, even if Gronk retires, even if they lose, I think they are going to be just fine.
I'm with you there, Bill. This is a great podcast, by the way.
Would you say it is the second best podcast on ESPN?
I got to take some time to think about that. Can I report back on the next time we do this show?
You can do your research. We will have you back on. We will rank the ESPN podcast from best to worst next time you are on field. But if anyone does not know where they can get more of you, please tell the people where they can get more Field EH in their life.
The feed that serves all the content up is my Twitter feed at Field Yates. That's where all my content will be funneled through. As you and I were discussing before the show, there's with four teams, a little bit less activity right now. I promise my hardest hitting stuff is coming your way through there. And probably some dogs, too.
Hard-hitting stuff? Hard-licking dogs? I'm not sure what the similar...
I'm dog-sitting for my mom this weekend. I'm very excited, Bill, at least until Sunday morning. Four dogs are in under my
eyes. Four dogs?
Eye.
Oh, man, yeah, this sounds so exciting.
It's a zoo. It's going to be great.
That's so good. All right, Field, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, thanks so much to my guests today, Dan Graziano, Field Yates, both of ESPN. Hope you guys enjoyed these playoff previews. If they're wrong, please just yell at me. Don't yell at the guests. They're just offering their insight. I am actually the dumb one. But we have more audio coming next week. We are going to recap these games. Of course, we're going to recap the conference championship games. And then the following week, we will be previewing the Super Bowl. Last year, we did two preview shows. Think we may do the same thing again this year, depending on which kind of guests we can get. But very excited to talk about these games on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. More audio on the way.